Testing 1, 2, 3, testing 1, 2. 1, 2, 3, testing 1, 2. 1, 2, 3, testing 1, 2, 1, 2. Is it working good? Okay, thanks.
Okay. Good morning. Good morning, everybody. Please take your seats now because we are going to start the 10th meeting of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is called to order. Distinguished members of the forum, today, as part of our new method of work under item 6 of the agenda, the forum will continue an in-depth comprehensive dialogue with the three remaining United Nations agencies, bodies, and funds. And we will first start with the Department of Economic and Social Affairs, the International Fund for Agricultural Development, and the UN United Nations Population Fund. But before we go into the in-depth dialogue, my attention has been called to the fact that today is the National Sorry Day for the of Australia, and our colleagues, the Aborigines of Australia, requested that they first be given the floor to say something about this day. And so I'm calling on Troy Bicknell, who will speak on behalf of the Aborigines from Australia. Thank you very much, Troy. Troy Bicknell, you have the floor.
Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. A copy of this statement has been given to the interpreters. Distinguished guests and international representatives, I acknowledge and pay my respects to the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet for the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. I pay tribute to all international custodians of their traditional lands, their elders and descendants. Today marks the 12th National Sorry Day since the release of the Bring Them Home Report of 1997 by the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission of the National Inquiry into the Separation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children from their families, now commonly referred to as the Stolen Generations. In the era of protection. The Australian government wanted to eradicate Indigenous peoples, put them on missions and reserves, isolate them from society with age restrictions and caste restrictions and assimilation rules, in the hope that Indigenous people would breed out and die out under the guise of it's for their betterment. The policies and rules of ordinances of 1910 to 1912 were modified to suit the application throughout the decades until approximately 1970 and varied by state and territory governments. In reality, the practice of removal occurred since colonisation, with black wars and massacres right up until 1940. This was reported in the Bringing Them Home report as genocide. In short, coloured or mixed race Indigenous children who were to be taken from their families, communities and lands and trained in institutions forbidden to practice their customs and language so they could eventually take up their place in society, in Australian society. These policies and practices contravened the human rights of all Indigenous Australians and in violation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights endorsed by the UN in 1948. Yet the report covered removal until 1972. This is evidence that the human rights of Indigenous Australians were not counted, nor visible, nor in the psyche when Australia signed off on that declaration. Aboriginal people were socially, politically, geographically, and economically excluded from Australian society. National, state, and territory governments lobbied for the implementation of the recommendations of that report. Eventually, all state and territory governments between 1998 and 2003 said, sorry. Public apologies were also recorded in thousands of sorry day books across Australia. Over the last 12 years, national sorry day events have been held in every state and territory. I would also like to commend the Australian government, who on February 13 last year gave a genuine and honest motion of apology to the Australian Indigenous peoples, which was passed by the Australian Parliament. This apology confirms without a doubt that the separation and removal of full blood Indigenous to missions and reserves and the removal and separation of half-caste Indigenous children to institutions were practice and policy. The inquiry captured 535 individual stories and 777 submissions, and we know there are many more. It was a belief by Stolen Generations and other Australians that the inquiry would bring justice. The Bringing Them Home report featured 54 recommendations, some with totalling 146 part recommendations. Approximately half the recommendations appear to have been implemented. National Sorry Day commemoration is recommendation 7A. For approximately the past 10 years, the Australian government has funded link-up organisations to fund and reconnect with family. The Australian government has established an Indigenous steering committee to implement a much-needed healing foundation to address the family and community traumatisation as a consequence of Australian government practice and policy. Finally, I dedicate this as a legacy to all those who were part of the Stolen Generations and have advocated and lobbied for the rights of Stolen Generations at state and national levels in Australia. For our grandmothers, great-grandmothers who were Stolen Generations, for our aunts, uncles and cousins, for many of them were stolen too. In closing, I know time is precious, and so too is the value of human life. Let us observe a minute's silence to reflect on the millions of people who will never make it back home, who have been lost, stolen, enslaved, persecuted, seeking refuge, and victims of genocide and disempowerment across our globe. Please stand for a minute's silence. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Mr. Troy Bicknell, who spoke on behalf of the Indigenous Peoples Caucus in Australia. Thank you very much. I would like now to take this opportunity to extend a warm welcome to the following distinguished representatives of DESA. First, to the Undersecretary General, Mr. Shah Sukang, who heads the Department of Economic and Social Affairs, and to the Assistant Secretary General, Mr. Jomo Sundaram, who is also with the Department of Economic and Social Affairs. They will make a presentation on behalf of DESA, after which we will open the floors for our colleagues in the permanent forum to raise some questions, and then we will get the responses, and after that we will also open it up to the floor. So I would like to ask Mr. Shah Sukang to please take the floor. You have the floor, sir.
Madam Chair and members of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, honorable elders, distinguished delegates, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to join you today for this in-depth dialogue of DESA with the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. The core objectives of DESA's work are defined by the United Nations Development Agenda. Our substantive focus spans from gender equality and the advancement of women to social policy and development, population, sustainable development, sustainable forest management, development policy and analysis, financing for development, public administration, and statistics. In all of these areas, we do cutting-edge research and in-depth policy analysis, and we provide crucial support to intergovernmental processes and capacity development. I take pride in the fact that much of this work is focused on indigenous issues. Six DESA divisions are here today to engage with you, to share with you their achievements, and to hear from you your expectations for future priorities. Let me briefly highlight the major functions of each of these divisions in relation to indigenous issues. The Division for Sustainable Development, DSD, supports Agenda 21, the Johannesburg Plan of Implementation, and Barbados Program of Action for Small Island Developing States, and serves as the Secretariat of the Commission on Sustainable Development, CSD. The United Nations Forum on Forest, UNFF Secretariat, promotes the management, conservation, and sustainable development of all types of forests. This includes efforts to strengthen long-term political commitment and action based on the forest principles and the non-legally binding instrument on all types of forests. On statistics division, UNSD, develops international statistical standards and methodological guidelines, collects and disseminates internationally comparable statistics, provides support to national statistical agencies, and supports the United Nations Statistical Commission as the apex of the global statistical system. The Division for Public Administration and Development Management, DPADM, is entrusted by the General Assembly to implement the United Nations Program in Public Administration and Development, and serves as a coordinated entity in this area. The Division for the Advancement of Women, DAW, provides support to United Nations intergovernmental bodies, including the General Assembly and the Commission on the Status of Women in their work on gender equality and the advancement of women. Finally, you are familiar with the Division for Social Policy and Development, DSPD, which includes within it the Secretariat of this forum. DSPD serves to strengthen international cooperation for social development and the social inclusion of older persons, youth, family, persons with disabilities, indigenous peoples, and other marginalized groups. The Division's work on indigenous issues is based on the mandate of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues assigned to it by the Economic and Social Council, as well as on mandates by the General Assembly, the most recent and central one being the adoption of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Madam Chairperson, we have before you the report of these six DESA divisions. It provides specific examples of DESA's contributions on indigenous issues. Let me share with you a framework for understanding DESA's work on indigenous issues in terms of four broad functional areas. First, DESA has facilitated participation by indigenous peoples in multi-stakeholder dialogues of intergovernmental processes. Indigenous peoples are recognized as a major group in Agenda 21. The Division for Sustainable Development and the United Nations Forum on Forest Secretariat work closely with indigenous peoples' organizations to enable their active participation in multi-stakeholder dialogues convened at each session of the CSD and UNFF. During the recent eighth session of the UNFF, major groups highlighted the fact that indigenous peoples manage an important share of the world forests, and that land tenure and ownership rights are a critical foundation for sustainable forest management. During CSD 17, held earlier this month, indigenous peoples participated in ministerial roundtables and multi-stakeholder dialogues. They called for prioritizing traditional knowledge within local and regional agricultural systems and strengthening legislation to ensure reform of land rights and land tenure systems in accordance with the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The Division for the Advancement of Women facilitates the participation of indigenous women in high-level roundtables and expert panels of the Commission on the Status of Women, which continues to address the situation of indigenous women in relation to the themes and issues considered at its session. Second, DESA has strived to include indigenous peoples in policy development and decision-making. During the 10-year review of Beijing Platform for Action, the Commission on the Status of Women, in response to the calls of indigenous peoples, adopted a resolution calling for measures to address the concerns of indigenous women throughout the implementation and the monitoring of the Beijing platform, and for the full participation of indigenous women in all aspects of society. And of course, the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is a major vehicle through which indigenous peoples participate in policy development. DESA also provides analysis of how indigenous peoples can participate in decision-making at national and local levels. In 2008, DESA's World Public Sector Report, produced by DPADM, highlighted innovative local government practices, featuring the experience of two cities in Ecuador, which are managed by indigenous mayors through a cross-cultural participatory approach. Third, DESA has made efforts to include indigenous peoples in statistics and disaggregated data, seeking to provide a sound basis of information for decision making. As the Permanent Forum has pointed out on various occasions, data collection and disaggregation concerning indigenous peoples pose unique challenges. The United Nations Expert Group on the 2010 World Program on Population and Housing Censuses, supported by DESA, produced the latest version of United Nations Principles and Recommendations for Population and Housing Censuses. This instrument elaborates in detail the need to disaggregate statistics on the basis of ethnocultural characteristics, especially with respect to indigenous populations. The statistics division, as part of the series of special topics, collected, processed, and disseminated data on ethnocultural characteristics as available in the year 2000 census round. This collection is available at its website and is complemented by the set of questions used in national censuses to capture these categories. Fourth, DESA promotes the integration of indigenous issues in United Nations technical cooperation and capacity development activities. DESA's intra-departmental task force on indigenous issues was recognized by the General Assembly in the year 2002. I'm pleased to announce that task force has designed and adopted the framework of DESA technical cooperation programs in countries with indigenous peoples. This framework is to be used as a tool in the formulation and implementation of DESA's capacity development activities. Madam Chairperson, my brief overview has highlighted some of DESA's contributions on indigenous issues. It shows that we at DESA attach top priority to indigenous issues working across divisions. Since I became the Undersecretary General for Economic and Social Affairs, I have always emphasized the need for DESA to work together to promote not merely development for all, but especially for the vulnerable groups. Indigenous peoples are among the most disadvantaged and vulnerable groups in the world today. The international community has recognized the need for special measures to protect the rights of the world's indigenous peoples. This has been and will remain a key priority of DESA during my term as Undersecretary General. In accomplishing this task, I will continue to rely on the Permanent Forum Secretariat. The Secretariat supports me in my role as coordinator of the second decade for the world's indigenous people, administering the related small grants program and carrying out other activities as mandated by the General Assembly. The Forum's Secretariat also promotes the implementation of a UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples throughout the UN system through the United Nations Interagency Support Group on Indigenous Issues and other means of international cooperation. Thanks to this effort, the United Nations Development Group last year adopted the UNDG guidelines on indigenous peoples' issues. DESA will continue to work tirelessly in engaging the UN system on indigenous issues. Madam Chairperson, your questions and feedback during the in-depth dialogue will certainly contribute to our ongoing work. I hope that it will also provide you with a better understanding of how DESA works for and with indigenous people. My able directors and other DESA staff are here to discuss further with you how DESA can be an even stronger partner and advocate for indigenous peoples and indigenous issues. Thank you.
I would like to thank Mr. Shasu Kang, the Under Secretary General for Economic and Social Affairs, for speaking to us today, and also for bringing his directors to have a dialogue with us. It's indeed a pleasure to meet all the different people who are assigned to the different divisions under the Department of Economic and Social Affairs, and to be able to really have this in-depth dialogue with them. In our practice since last week, we have assigned several of our distinguished colleagues from the forum to raise some questions to the DESA and, of course, to all your members. So I will start because myself and Mr. Mick Dodson were the ones asked to do something on DESA, and I would like to go through some of the questions that we have formulated, which we hope can be responded to by the representatives of DESA. First, under the Division for the Advancement of Women, we would like to know how does the division perceive the impact of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in its activities and overall directions. And we would also like to know concretely what the Division of Advancement of Women has contributed towards empowerment of Indigenous women's organizations and networks, although we note that in your report, it was mentioned, in the report that was submitted to the forum, it was mentioned that the capacities and resources of the division to work specifically with Indigenous women are limited. So we would like to know this kind of constraint and how to overcome such constraint. We also would like to raise some questions on the Division on Sustainable Development. We know that this is the division that provides services for the Commission on Sustainable Development, and several of our colleagues were present in the previous two-week session on the Commission, and we noted that we actually gladly noted there were several references for the first time in the final report that came out of the Commission's meeting. No, even if there were difficulties in the negotiations, when we saw the report, we really saw a lot of references to the report, including acknowledging the adoption of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which was quite a difficult thing to do last year. So our question is, again, in relation to the declaration, how does the division perceive how this declaration can affect its activities and overall direction, including its technical cooperation assistance? No? Because you will be you do provide technical assistance, so we are wondering whether this is something that can figure into the technical assistance that you are doing, considering that you are part of developing also the UNDG guidelines on indigenous peoples. Then, of course, we also would like to know how the department, how the Division on Sustainable Development has helped in strengthening indigenous peoples' organizations and networks. The last thing on my list, and I'll move on to Mr. Dodson, is on the Secretariat of the UN Forum on Forests. No, some indigenous peoples have been actively participating since the UN Forum on Forests has been established, but in the end, I think that for the past 3 years, many of them have sort of given up in taking part in the UN Forum on Forests, because there was this perception and experience that a lot of the discussions there have become either so sterile or totally taken over by the forest industry, and indigenous peoples felt alienated in that whole process. So I'm very glad that the UN Forum on Forest is here. So the questions are also related to the same ones I mentioned earlier. Now that the Declaration on Indigenous Peoples had been has been adopted, what implications will this have on the work of the Secretariat on the UN Forum on Forests? And how could the views and contributions of major groups be better incorporated into the discussions and decision-making on forest policy and sustainable forest management issues in particular? As we all know, suddenly there is a very strong renewed interest on forests, specifically because the climate change has identified that deforestation is causing 20% of greenhouse gas emissions, and if we would like to control the greenhouse gas emissions, something has to be done about forests. And we know also for a fact that many forests, the last remaining forests, tropical forests in the world today, are actually in indigenous territory, and many indigenous peoples are really pushing that the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples becomes a framework to be used when talking about forest management and the contributions of forests to climate change solutions. Thirdly, how can the forest UNFF Secretariat improve and increase the major group stakeholder participation, including indigenous peoples, in the future sessions of the forum? Indigenous peoples have reported that multi-stakeholder dialogues on forest policy are inappropriate vehicles through which to channel their views, because the results of these dialogues are rarely included in the reports of the Secretary General. And therefore, we would like to know if there are opportunities to address this situation. I would like to move on now to my colleague, Mr. Mick Dodson, to ask questions on the Statistics Division and the other bodies. Yes, Mick, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson, and good morning, everyone. Madam Chair, this is the first time I've spoken at this session of the forum. I would like to congratulate you on being elected as our chairperson, and also congratulate our colleagues who have been elected to the Bureau as deputy chairs. I also want to congratulate our brother, Les Malta, who was awarded the Australian Human Rights Commission Human Rights Medal for his wonderful work over many years internationally and domestically back home in Australia. I also want to congratulate our sister, Mrs. Dan, for her award of the Human Rights Defenders Medal. And also, along with many others, I want to congratulate the Australian Government for endorsing the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. So, Australia, our challenge now is to have the Declaration fully implemented back home. My questions to DESA are to the Stats Division, the Division of Public Administration and Development Management, and the Division for Social Policy and Development, primarily the Secretariat for the Permanent Forum. But first, I want to warmly thank Mr. Xia Zhuzhang for being available for this dialogue with us today. It's very much appreciated, I'm sure, by all. Firstly, to the Stats Division, has the Statistics Division adopted measures to improve the identification of Indigenous peoples in the upcoming 2010 round of censuses? And if so, does it also include the full participation of Indigenous peoples in this process? My second question for the Statistics Division is, are statistical issues pertaining to Indigenous peoples mainstream when developing handbooks and guidelines within the Statistics Division? I have two questions for the Division for Public Administration and Development Management. Firstly, how does DPADM perceive the impact of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in its activities in relation to Indigenous peoples? And secondly, could you please assess the impact of having Indigenous women as the target group in your projects? For the Division for Social Policy and Development, the Secretariat of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, how does the Secretariat mainstream gender equality in its work, and how are Indigenous youth perspectives incorporated into the work of the Secretariat? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mick Dodson. I would like to turn now to our colleagues, the heads of the various divisions of DESA, and I guess you have sort of self-organized, so I would like to see which flag is going to come up first to respond to the questions before we move on to the other participants in this room. Yes, you have the floor, and please identify yourself.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson. My name is Christina Brautigam. I'm from the Division for the Advancement of Women of the Department of Economic and Social Affairs, and I send also the greetings as well as apologies of our director who is traveling on mission. So I have the honor to be here and engage with the members of the Permanent Forum in this dialogue. I want to thank you, Madam Chairperson, for the questions that you have addressed to the Division for the Advancement of Women and for the opportunity to respond to them. Now, the first question pertained to the Division's perceived impact of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples on our activities and overall direction. The Division has experience with another declaration of the General Assembly, namely the 1993 Declaration on the Elimination of Violence Against Women. That declaration has and constitutes a very solid and very strong basis for the work of the United Nations generally on the elimination of violence against women. And in that sense, I would believe and hope that the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples will also take on a similar strong role in the work of the UN system in regard to Indigenous peoples. Article 22, paragraph 2 of the Declaration requires states to take specific measures to ensure that Indigenous women and children enjoy the full protection and guarantees against violence and discrimination. And the Declaration therefore enhances the existing international legal and policy framework as it pertains to gender equality and provides further impetus for targeted action. The Declaration will help guide our analytical work in the Division as it pertains to Indigenous women and will also strengthen our substantive support to intergovernmental processes in regard to Indigenous women. Now, in regard to the second question that you have posed, which is how the Division contributes and has contributed towards the empowerment of Indigenous women's organizations and networks, I would suggest that taking into account the Division's overall responsibilities, there are essentially two ways in which we have contributed towards the empowerment of Indigenous women's organizations and their networks. The first area would be through our research and policy analysis work, and the second would be through our role in supporting intergovernmental processes focused on gender equality, and in particular in our work to convene panels and expert group meetings as well as in facilitating the participation of experts and non-governmental organizations in our work and in that of the Commission on the Status of Women. If I can give a couple of examples in regard to our research and analysis work, I can mention the 2006 study of the Secretary General on all forms of violence against women. In that study, the division had the opportunity to highlight that indigenous women are not only victims of different forms of violence against women, but are often subjected to violence at much higher rates than non-indigenous women. The study recommended as a promising practice in law that measures taken to address violence against women should take into account the differential impact on women according to their indigenous status. In regard to the participation of indigenous women, I should mention that indigenous women's organizations contributed submissions to the preparatory process of the Secretary General's study and also used the momentum generated by the study's preparatory process to issue a study on their own. Another area in which we have, through our research and analysis, been able to flag the situation of indigenous women is the Secretary General's database on violence against women, which the division has developed and which it maintains and which was launched in March of 2009. The database does contain information on measures taken by member states to address violence against women in a number of areas. And the database does include indigenous women as one of the keywords by which a user can search for and obtain information. And just to give one example, information submitted by Canada contains 8 entries on indigenous women in the areas of domestic and sexual violence. Another area or another example that I could provide in regard to our research and analysis work is the fact that in regard to our work on the priority theme of the Commission on the Status of Women of 2007, which was on the elimination of all forms of discrimination and violence against the girl child, the division had an opportunity to flag the situation and to give special attention to the question of indigenous girls within the context of education and economic opportunities. In 2005, in the lead-up to the 10-year review of the implementation of the Beijing Platform for Action, the division summarized actions taken by governments to address the situation of indigenous women. And the report of the Secretary General on the review included a separate chapter on the situation of indigenous women with information on actions and policies aimed at improving their status and on the obstacles and challenges with respect to eliminating discrimination against indigenous women and overcoming their social and economic exclusion. Also in our work on the situation of rural women, we have paid specific attention to the forms of discrimination faced by rural indigenous women. This was highlighted in particular in a report that we submitted in 2007 to the General Assembly. We have also paid attention to the situation of rural women in a publication on rural women in a changing world of 2008. In regard to the second area of our work, namely our role in supporting intergovernmental processes focused on gender equality, I could just highlight a couple of panels where we had indigenous women participate as panelists, for example, in 2008, at an expert panel on gender perspectives in climate change. We had Mrs. Anastasia Pinto, an indigenous woman of the Meitei Nation in India, as one of the panelists in an interactive event that examined the emerging issue of gender perspectives and climate change. The panel highlighted the need to include indigenous women in climate-related decision-making and noted that indigenous women were particularly susceptible to the negative impact of natural disasters. We also had, I believe, you, Madam Chairperson, as one of the panelists in conjunction with the 2005 implementation of the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action. We also had in 2006 on the occasion of International Women's Day 2008, which focused on the question of women in decision-making. Ms. Noelle Bocaterra, the president of the Permanent Commission of Indigenous Peoples, National Assembly of Venezuela, is one of the panelists. These are some of the examples in which we have endeavored to contribute towards the empowerment of indigenous women's organizations and their networks. Now, in regard to the last question pertaining to the limited capacities and resources of the division to work specifically on indigenous women, I could perhaps elaborate that given the particular mandate of the Division for the Advancement of Women and the work program, which is guided by the Commission on the Status of Women and the decisions taken by intergovernmental processes, we have in fact had opportunity to highlight the situation of indigenous women as part of this multi-year program of work and the various thematic areas of consideration. However, so far there has not yet been within the multi-year program of work of the Commission on the Status of Women a specific theme on the situation of indigenous women, nor have we been mandated to prepare specific reports focused exclusively on the situation of indigenous women. And therefore, given that that our mandate is focused overall on gender equality, we have, of course, endeavored to focus on the situation of indigenous women and to highlight particular constraints and challenges they face, but have not so far worked exclusively or in a very targeted fashion only at the question of indigenous women. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Is there any other member of the panel who... Yes, please, you have the floor.
My name is Sergen Markic. I'm today representing the Statistics Division of the Department of Economic and Social Affairs. Allow me first to express the appreciation for being invited to discuss the work of the Statistics Division before such a distinguished forum, and we really welcome the opportunity. In regards to the questions that were raised in terms of the activities pertaining to the 2010 round of censuses and whether the Statistics Division adopted measures to improve the identification of indigenous peoples, I would like to emphasize that the major gathering for defining international statistical standards is the United Nations Statistical Commission, which is a body representing all the statistical offices that are our sister partners at the national levels. The last time the United Nations Statistical Commission discussed the 2010 World Program on Population Housing Censuses was a year and a half ago, and during that deliberations it was clearly outlined that the goal of the 2010 World Program is to enumerate all the persons in the world in the 2010 round of censuses, which is a period of 10 years covering 2005 until 2014. The major recommendation, therefore, is for each country to undertake at least one population and housing census in the period of 10 years during that census decade. In order for a census to be successful, it has to ensure full coverage of all the persons within a certain area of a country at the national level. In order to achieve this level of quality, it is of course necessary to undertake a fieldwork that involves consulting with the existing social structures. And in many cases, the indigenous people do have the social structures that are necessary in terms to ensure that the quality of the census, that the enumeration of all the people is conducted in a proper manner. How do we achieve this? In the set of guidelines that the UN Statistics Division developed, it is clearly outlined that all the questionnaires that are part of the population and housing census have to be translated in all the languages, more specifically to the indigenous languages in the areas where it is expected to have a majority of the indigenous population. Second, we advise all the countries that when undertaking the population housing census to ensure that the enumerators, that is, the technicians that interview people, that fill in the questionnaires, are recruited from the indigenous communities in order again to ensure a full collaboration and high quality of the replies. Finally, we also advise all the countries through our workshops and through our publications that we are issuing in terms of technical support for population housing censuses. We advise them that they have to work with elders in the indigenous communities to ensure that the goal of the census is well understood by the indigenous people and that the results are, once they are available, are used for fostering the issues pertinent to the indigenous people, more specifically the issues that are related to the work of other sister divisions in the Department of Economic and Social Affairs, such as the climate change and the sustainable development and the forest and so on and so forth. Therefore, in answer to the question, I would like to outline that a population and housing census is a field operation, and we have developed a number of clear statistical guidelines and technical programs, including a set of workshops that we carry throughout the world, in each region of the world, with the message that the national statistical organizations must ensure a complete coverage of all the people in their national boundaries, with specific emphasis on indigenous people, given sometimes elusiveness in covering those regions and those people. Let me just emphasize one point that I believe is of interest to this forum, and that is the fact that in statistical work it is extremely important to have clearly defined definitions when it comes to the indigenous peoples, when it comes to the ethnicity, when it comes to the ethnic groups, and so on and so forth. In that respect, I would like to outline that at this moment we do not have an internationally agreed classification of ethnicities, which makes identifying special indigenous groups or special ethical group a bit different from the point of view of standardization at the international level. When it comes to the second question regarding the full participation of indigenous peoples in the process of the 2010 round of censuses, the Statistics Division undertook a broad program of hands-on seminars and workshops in all the regions of the world, with, again, the same message that the inclusion of the indigenous people is one of the first priorities for a census, for a population housing census, to claim to be successful. Another question, Madam Chair, refers to whether the statistical issues pertaining to indigenous people mainstreamed when developing handbooks and guidelines within the Statistics Division. And I'm very happy to answer with an overwhelming yes, very much so, in all the areas where the unit of enumeration or the unit of tabulation, as we say in our statistical parlance, is a person, the Statistics Division clearly emphasized the need to pay specific attention to the indigenous people and to the minorities, and especially to the minorities based on ethnicity. I will give you just one example. One of the crucial issues that we are facing in many countries of the world is the lack of valid vital statistics, which are the statistics on births and deaths and marriages and divorces. And these statistics are usually generated out of the registration, of the civil registration system, that unfortunately in many countries of the world is deficient. It is especially deficient, we have noted, when it comes to the registration of indigenous people. In order to rectify and to try to resolve this issue at the level of the national data collection activities as well as international standards, our handbooks on civil registration and vital statistics clearly emphasize the need to put additional efforts in the areas of the country populated by indigenous people in order to have the registration reaching them all. Just for the sake of example, at this current moment, in 50% of the countries of the world, the registration system does not function properly, and we do not have a clear answer to the questions how many babies are born every day in the world, and where are they born, and of which parents, and so on and so forth. This is just to illustrate the issues that are really linked to perhaps a more deeply rooted regarding the national statistical systems, as well as how the statistics division of DESA is trying to address them through the series of handbooks and through the series of workshops and seminars that we undertake on a regular basis. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, sir. Well, I just wanted to say that we are very glad to hear about these efforts being taken by the statistics division, because this has been a major concern for indigenous peoples in many parts of the world. And the point you raise about civil registration is really a problem. Maybe if it's 50% in the world that are not registered, maybe it really will be higher for indigenous peoples. We have reports from countries who are saying that many indigenous peoples really don't have, are not registered, both births as well as other statistics, whether on health statistics, and therefore it doesn't really give a very accurate picture of the numbers of indigenous peoples as well as the situation that they face. So I hope we will be able to use this opportunity to really pursue more effective engagement between us, between the Secretariat of the Forum and you, and also between indigenous peoples in the various countries. Because I was made aware, I visited your office, and I was made aware that it's your division and the Commission on Statistics that really sort of validate a lot of the existing statistics, and we would really be keen to pursue this further. Thank you very much. I'd like to see who is in the... yes, please, you have the floor. Our... woman friend, then we'll go back to the next item. The one here. No, no, sorry. You, the one on the brown shirt. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm David O'Connor. I'm representing the director of the Division for Sustainable Development. I'm the head of the Policy Analysis Branch. And I would like to answer your first question, Madam Chair, and then turn it over to my colleague, Ms. Tonya Vaturi, to answer your second question. I'd like to thank you all for the opportunity to participate in this dialogue. We in the Division for Sustainable Development come to listen and to learn and to see how our work is perceived by the members of the Permanent Forum and to understand how we might engage more actively with the Forum and with Indigenous peoples in our own work to make it more relevant and responsive to your concerns. From the start, the concerns of indigenous peoples have been recognized by the architects of international sustainable development governance. The Brundtland Commission report in 1987 states in paragraph 46, tribal and indigenous peoples will need special attention as the forces of economic development disrupt their traditional lifestyles, lifestyles that can offer modern societies many lessons in the management of resources in complex forest, mountain, and dry land ecosystems. Some are threatened with virtual extinction by insensitive development over which they have no control. Their traditional rights should be recognized, and they should be given a decisive voice in formulating policies about resource development in their areas. And then we have Agenda 21's Chapter 26, which is devoted to recognizing and strengthening the role of indigenous people and their communities, including through establishment of a process to empower indigenous people and their communities, establishment of arrangements to strengthen the active participation of indigenous people and their communities in national formulation of policies, laws, and programs relating to resource management and other development processes, and the involvement of indigenous people and their communities at the national and local levels in resource management and conservation strategies. 20 years after Brundtland and 15 after Rio, the General Assembly, during its 61st session, adopted the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The Division for Sustainable Development is the UN body with the mandate to track, monitor, and work to accelerate implementation of commitments made in Rio, in Johannesburg, as well as those to the sustainable development of the small island developing states made in Barbados and Mauritius. So how does the above-mentioned declaration influence our work? First, there is the normative work of the Commission on Sustainable Development itself, which, as Undersecretary of DESA, Mr. Shaw, mentioned earlier, just completed its 17th session a week and a half ago, with an agreed resolution on the themes of agriculture, rural development, land, drought, desertification, and Africa, all themes which are of particular importance to indigenous peoples, and so one would expect to see reflected in this agreement. As was also mentioned earlier, the preamble does acknowledge the adoption of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, as well as the importance of local and indigenous knowledge, in particular regarding the conservation and sustainable use of biological diversity, calling for the equitable sharing of the benefits therefrom. The sections on rural development and land call for secure and enforceable land rights supported by appropriate legal frameworks, including the recognition of customary tenure arrangements. They refer to the need to harmonize modern technologies with traditional and indigenous knowledge, and they also call for participation of indigenous peoples in land and rural development planning at local and national levels. Other decisions explicitly referring to indigenous peoples call for promotion of access to education and training, to markets and credit, and to sustainable livelihoods. So some key concerns of indigenous peoples are addressed in the latest CSD decision, as the chair so rightly pointed out. Will they be addressed in practice? That depends on the political resolve of governments and of indigenous peoples themselves and their organizations, your organizations. It also depends on the UN system to the extent that it is charged with implementation. In the division's analytical work, we have addressed, although perhaps not as much as we might, some issues of concern to indigenous people. In a recent issue of our Sustainable Development Innovation Briefs, for example, we addressed the issue of non-renewable resource revenues and how they can be used for local sustainable development, calling for the strengthening of the capacity of local communities to engage in decisions on revenue allocation and use, and also their capacities to negotiate with outside interests like multinational mining companies. A recent analysis of the links between forest and biodiversity conservation and climate change mitigation touches on the issue of RED, reduced emissions from deforestation and land degradation, of which I'm sure you'll hear more from our colleagues in the Forum on Forests. But in particular, it addresses the concerns of indigenous issues in the following terms, and I quote, "Forest-dependent communities are understandably concerned to ensure that the augmented value of standing forests not become cause for powerful interest groups to assert property rights over those assets in contravention of their customary rights, whether formal or informal. In our technical cooperation work, we need to be more cognizant of the concerns and the contributions of indigenous peoples. We do not have extensive field-level technical cooperation, but our work can help shape government strategies and policies, and as importantly, the processes by which those strategies and policies get made. Thus, in the advisory work of our Division on National Sustainable Development Strategies, participatory approaches involving all stakeholders, including indigenous groups, are stressed. In the coming biennium, our division will be initiating 2 development account projects of relevance to indigenous peoples, one on mainstreaming climate change adaptation into national sustainable development strategies in Latin America and the Caribbean, and another on addressing water variability and water stress in national and local resource planning. In both cases, we look forward to engaging with the Permanent Forum and with representatives of indigenous communities in the countries where the projects will be implemented, and in more systematically drawing upon and integrating traditional knowledge into our understanding of how to address these challenges. So I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I now pass the mic to my colleague, Tonya Vaturi, to answer the second question.
Yes, please. And I also would like you to highlight the most important things, because we have to open the floor also for the other indigenous participants. Thank you very much.
Can I get this off? How do I turn it off?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chairperson, and thank you to the members of the Permanent Forum for inviting us here for this very innovative dialogue today. I'd like to thank you, David, first for elaborating on the ways that the declaration affects the work of our division, and I believe that he covered many of the points that I would like to also build upon in answering the question of how DSD contributed towards the empowerment of Indigenous peoples, organizations, and networks. As he mentioned, there are many ways in which Indigenous peoples are affected by the work of the division, and the work of the division is also contributing to some of the progress on the ground with the declaration and some of the work of the forum. Historically, the division has created innovative spaces for the participation of Indigenous peoples through the activities of the Major Groups Program, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the process-related ways in which Indigenous peoples have been a part of the CSD process. I'd also like to cover some of the ways in which DSD has strengthened and supported the existing mechanisms that provide a platform for Indigenous local-local cooperation and establishment of networks of Indigenous local governments for information exchange and capacity building. The division has collaborated closely with other DESA colleagues in the past year to develop, fund, and launch DESA's integrated civil society organization system to facilitate interactions among civil society organizations and DESA at all levels. The ICSO system is an online database that includes all NGOs in consultative status with ECOSOC and is also open to any interested civil society organizations that wish to provide information and can serve as a potential tool for collaboration and networking among CSOs at all levels. Indigenous peoples organizations and other NGOs working with and or for Indigenous and local communities can be selected as search fields and identified based on location, regional scope, areas of activity, and other data. Data and indicators on Indigenous peoples at the national level is available through the division's national reporting mechanism and also through the compendium of country-by-country profiles developed by the workers and trade union sector. The division maintains a web page dedicated to Indigenous peoples as one of the 9 major group sectors identified in Agenda 21. And last year, during the 7th session of the Permanent Forum, DSD hosted a side event that promoted and informed Indigenous groups on opportunities for involvement within the CSD process. Within the past cycle of the CSD, the last 2 years, Indigenous peoples groups have submitted written inputs to the Secretary General's reports. They've produced examples of case studies that have been included in not only a database, but in preparation of official discussion papers through the coordination of a steering group of Indigenous organizations that is led by TEBTEBA, the Indigenous Peoples International Center for Policy Research and Education, and by the Indigenous Environmental Network. Furthermore, a special study on Indigenous peoples in Africa in relation to the CSD agenda was also prepared and submitted by this steering group. Indigenous peoples organizations have participated in CSD 16 and 17, as well as high-level intersessional meetings through a number of different entry points that hopefully have provided very creative spaces for their views and perspectives to be heard by member states. Multi-stakeholder dialogues are the traditional vehicle that we use to incorporate the views of Indigenous peoples and other major groups into the CSD process. And this year, we had a new innovative dialogue that also included heads of UN agencies, funds, and programs, as well as ministers. Thematic discussions, regional discussions, discussions on small island developing states, and statements during opening and closing plenaries are all open to Indigenous peoples groups, as is participation in the Partnerships Fair, the Learning Center, and the many side events that take place during the CSD meetings. Apart from the CSD process, DSD also supports Indigenous peoples' active involvement in the 10-year framework of programs on sustainable consumption and production, and recognizes 19 multi-stakeholder partnerships for sustainable development that are currently working with and for Indigenous communities at local, regional, and global levels to address issues related to water, agricultural heritage, land, biodiversity protection, and biotrade development. Recognizing the special needs of Africa, DSD is also undertaking measures to establish a long-term program for Africa that will be implemented in close cooperation and coordination of the African continent. The division collaborates with other UN agencies in support of NAPAD, and in partnership with UNDP supports capacity-building initiatives for the planning of water-related national strategies and infrastructures developments in the region in line with related MDGs. DSD also currently provides financial support for technical projects currently underway in the Africa region under NAPAD, addressing international partnerships for new and emerging technologies for sustainable development in Senegal and Ghana, capacity building for interregional electricity access and supply in Africa, in the East and Central sub-regions, and strengthening national capacity for the integration of sustainable development principles into development strategies in countries emerging from conflict, which also involves the Asia and Pacific region. Since the inception in 1993, the Commission on Sustainable Development has maintained its policy to include Indigenous peoples' issues and organizations in its work as part of Agenda 21 follow-up, and the Major Groups Program provides the focus within DSD for these activities. The obstacles that the Division for Sustainable Development faces in empowering Indigenous peoples' organizations and networks primarily is related to the legislative mandates that regulate the Division's work and to the limited funding for supportive programs and projects specific to Indigenous peoples. Although it avails limited funding to Indigenous people and other major groups participants from developing countries to enable their participation in CSD-related meetings. On average, 2 to 4 representatives nominated by the Indigenous Peoples sector are funded annually to participate in regional, intersessional, and CSD meetings. Factors that facilitate enable DSD to contribute to empowerment of Indigenous Peoples organizations and networks include the strength and innovative nature of the Major Groups Program, whose mandate and goals include enhancing the participation and effective involvement of major groups, including Indigenous Peoples, in Agenda 21 and JPOI follow-up, and implementation processes, and in the Mauritius strategy for SIDS, and continuing to provide for more direct and substantive involvement of major groups, including Indigenous peoples, in the work of the CSD. Furthermore, DSD and the Permanent Forum share similar mandated issue areas, most notably in economic and social development and the environment, which are defined as the three pillars of sustainable development, as well as education and health, which are both cross-cutting issues for every cycle of the CSD. This makes the nature and aims of our work very similar and enables the division to address many areas of relevance and importance to the Permanent Forum. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to just say that, of course, we thank the division and for supporting Indigenous peoples. And we do recognize that 2 to 3 Indigenous persons participating in the CSD is not enough, so we are thinking of trying to see how to support even more Indigenous persons. And I'd also like to tell the Indigenous peoples here that we do participate in the CSD sessions, but if you complain that you have 3 minutes only here, in the CSD they only have 1 minute to speak. So you should just think about how difficult it is to accommodate all the different stakeholders in the CSD, and we do have a bigger possibility to really speak more about this. So we should contribute the results of this work to the CSD so that this can also be integrated into the report. And finally, on this issue, next year, the theme of the Commission on Sustainable Development is on mining, pollution, sustainable consumption and production, and I think waste management. So it's really a very good theme for us. So we are going to, we have finished an expert group meeting on extractive industries, and we would like this to be considered in the next session of the CSD, because we really designed it to be this way, so we will be able to engage more actively in the themes that you are going to address next year. Thank you very much. Okay, the next person, yes, please.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm representing the Secretariat of the United Nations Forum on Forests, and let me tell you that we feel extremely honored to be invited to participate in this dialogue, and we are very grateful for your very pertinent questions. As Indigenous peoples are among the major groups, they have since long been actively participating and interacting with member states in the meetings of the UNFF and its predecessors. 36 of the IPF-IFF proposals for action, 5 of the UNFF resolutions, and 1 ECOSOC resolution on the strengthening of the UNFF have been dealing with issues relevant to Indigenous peoples. Obviously, 2007 opened a new era in the cooperation, and the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples has a number of articles that are particularly relevant to the use and protection of natural resources, among which forests are the ones the Forum is particularly concerned with. In December 2007, the General Assembly adopted the non-legal binding instrument on all types of forests, a strong political document which promotes the sustainable management of all types of forests and which can only be achieved with the engagement of all interested parties, including indigenous peoples. The non-legally binding instrument has a number of national policy recommendations and international action items aimed at the participation in and contribution to SFM by indigenous communities. Implementing the declaration and implementing the non-legally binding instrument creates a very fortunate win-win situation for both the Permanent Forum and UNFF. The multi-year program of the Forum includes for UNFF 9, that is going to be held in 2011, the overall theme, Forests for People, Livelihoods and Poverty Eradication, where one of the subjects will be social development and indigenous and other local and foreign dependent communities, including forest land tenure. In its most recent decision or resolution, the UNFF invited major groups and other forest stakeholders to provide inputs to the 9th session of the Forum on these issues, inter alia, through sharing regional experiences, approaches, and perspectives. This resolution further invites the members of the Collaborative Partnership on Forests to provide information to UNFF 9 on recent developments in the areas of sustainable forest management, climate change, deforestation, land degradation, desertification, and biodiversity, including impacts on indigenous and other local and forest-dependent communities. Madam Chair, I have to take note of the criticism you expressed regarding experiences with previous UNFF sessions, but we sincerely hope that the most recent experiences are more favorable. And we understand that active participation of major groups into the discussion of the Forum and its intersessional activities should even be further encouraged. And I do hope that the recent experiences of the Vienna open-ended ad hoc expert group meeting and the informal consultations held in Rome were good examples of these efforts. We understand that major groups' views and contributions could be presented in a coordinated and focused manner as early as possible in the course of the discussions, and the joint statements by the major groups delivered during UNFF 8 could be seen as an encouraging example. During UNFF 8, we also experimented with a new approach in the multi-stakeholder dialogue, having it organized in two different phases. The first phase was conducted early on in order to be able to provide an opportunity for major groups to contribute to the scene setting for the negotiations, and then we conducted the second part in the course of the second week, where major groups had the opportunity to reflect on the developments and contribute to shaping the final outcome of the negotiations. I'm very happy to inform the distinguished members of the Forum that during UNFF 8, major groups announced their interest to organize the first ever major group-led initiative, which is going to be seen as an intersessional activity of the Forum to discuss issues relevant for their work and for their concern. We hope that there will be sufficient interest in member states in supporting this initiative, and the Secretariat obviously will do its utmost to make this happen. And finally, Madam Chair, in response to your third question, I would like to underline that the active engagement of all the major groups should be further encouraged in different areas of the work of the Forum. As stated in Resolution 8.1 of the UNFF, member states are encouraged, and the UNFF Secretariat is requested to explore ways to increase stakeholder and civil society participation, including indigenous and other local and forest-dependent communities and other holders of traditional forest-related knowledge, in future sessions of the Forum. The Secretariat continues to inform and cooperate actively with major group representatives on current issues and developments in relation to sustainable forest management. suggestions relating to the structure and form of multi-stakeholder dialogue, as well as other possible forms of participation, may be considered in cooperation with major groups. The multi-stakeholder dialogues are obviously recorded in the chairman's summaries and as such are annexed to reports of the session. And the last and minor point, Madam Chair, that obviously the Secretariat is committed to continue supporting the participation of major groups at major UNFF-related events. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, the Division on Forum of Forest. I would like to, who is the, is there anybody else left to speak? Yes, please.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm glad to represent today the Division for Public Administration and Development Management. First of all, we want to thank the organizers of the forum for inviting us to share our work with you today. I will be very direct for time's sake, and I will directly like to address the first question. How has the declaration impacted the work of our Division for Public Administration and Development Management? And I'm glad to say that this has already impacted us, and it has translated into concrete activities in the last years. But most importantly, it's also fostering and speeding up our efforts into the future. And I will also refer briefly to some activities that are in the pipeline. As to what has already been done, I have to the pleasure of saying that we have included in the global governance inventory a rich number of initiatives aimed at reducing the distance between discourse and action in the exercise of rights of indigenous peoples at different government levels. We have also worked on a knowledge base on civic participation as it comes to indigenous people, and in particular, we are offering online training for local governments about the participation and rights of indigenous women and men. Very importantly, we are beginning to work on indicators on civic participation and participatory governance institutions as it comes to indigenous peoples. Moreover, in the past, we have included in the World Public Sector Report 2008, entitled People Matter, Civic Engagement in Public Governance, some important references to the participation of indigenous peoples. In particular, we gathered very rich information about the experience of two cities in Ecuador, Cotacachi and Otavalo, that we were glad to include in the report as references on good practices that other countries and nations may consider. Also, in the panel discussion that we organized on April 2008, Managing Indigenous Local Governments, Balancing Traditions and Emerging Challenges, we were honored to have a high representation from the Australian government and the Secretariat, as well as panelists coming from Ecuador, Morocco, Australia, and other countries, with a total of 70 participants representing the UN member states. UNDESA, through our division, has also organized and participated in the first meeting of indigenous mayors in Latin America, held in Quito, Ecuador, in 2008. On the second question, Madam Chairperson, how to assess the impact of having indigenous women as a target group? We must say that this is quite a delicate and important matter. First, because this group has the two dimensions of being a special group within society as indigenous people, but also of being disadvantaged as women within their own indigenous communities. We suggest that besides the general importance of this, we in the future concentrate on some specific issues that can be very concrete and that can be addressed in this connection. For example, the challenges of feminization of rural communities due to outmigration of males income earners, which is threatening the traditional social protection networks and needs to define new policies with imagination and creativity. To this sake, we envision that participation of women from indigenous peoples can enrich very much the definition of policy, implementation, and monitoring in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yes, please, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Jean-Pierre Gounod. I'm the Acting Director of the Division for Social Policy and Development. First of all, Madam Chair, and I'm mindful of the time that flies, we're very pleased at this innovative initiative of the Permanent Forum to hold this in-depth dialogue. Let me also say that the Division for Social Policy and Development that I represent here is really proud to host the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum. It is a very active branch that supports the forum and promotes indigenous issues in the UN system and throughout the world. I mean, the work of our colleagues is really an inspiration to the entire division. You ask us, Madam Chair, how does the Secretariat of the Forum mainstream gender equality in its work? The division in its entirety, and in particular the Secretariat of the Forum, has been following with a particular attention the policy messages of the Permanent Forum and paying attention to gender, including indigenous women's issues, on various fronts. The efforts of the Secretariat of the Forum are in three main areas: raising awareness, operational activities, and capacity building and technical cooperation, and integrating indigenous gender issues in reports of the Secretary General. Let me first address raising awareness. The Secretariat has worked very closely with various indigenous women's organizations on major topics that require international attention. This was, for example, the case with the high-level panel organized in 2004 at the annual session of the Commission on the Status of Women, on Indigenous Women and Conflict Resolution and Peacebuilding, that including Indigenous women leaders from various regions and the President of the Security Council. In fact, the result of that panel found their ways in recommendations issued by the Permanent Forum in 2004. Another example was the 10-year commemoration of the Beijing Conference in 2005, when the Secretariat cooperated closely with the International Forum of Indigenous Women for an historic gathering of 50 indigenous women leaders at UN headquarters. This led to the first ever resolution on indigenous women at the Commission on the Status of Women. Let me now come to the operational activities of the Secretariat of the Forum. The Secretariat has made efforts to bring awareness for enhanced action of the UN system on the ground that will reach indigenous women. For this purpose, the Secretariat, together with other UN entities, achieved the establishment of a working group on indigenous women in the Interagency Group on Women and Gender Equality. This interagency working group that worked from 2004 to 2007 did an overview of activities on indigenous women in the UN system and produced a publication on good practices of the UN system work with indigenous women that has been published in English and Spanish and has been disseminated to all UN country teams. Moreover, the Secretariat, together with other UN system agency funds and programs, prepared the UNDG guidelines on indigenous peoples' issues adopted last year. The guidelines, which also integrate the principle of the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, now constitute the operational tool that all UN country teams around the world should follow. The guidelines have included gender aspects as well. Capacity development and technical cooperation. Since 2005, the Secretariat of the Forum has been working to implement the UN Development Account project entitled Engaging Indigenous Women, Local Government Capacity Building Through New Technologies in Latin America. This project is being carried out in cooperation with indigenous women's organizations and local authorities, as well as UN agencies in three Andean countries, namely Ecuador, Peru, and Bolivia. Under the Small Grants Program of the Second International Decade of the World's Indigenous People, the Secretariat has implemented a total of 10 projects focusing on Indigenous women out of 57. That's 18% of the project during the period 2006-2008. Integration of Indigenous gender issues in major report of the Secretary General. As you know, the Secretariat systematically contributes to major studies of the Secretary General to the General Assembly or the Security Council, bringing Indigenous gender perspective. This was, for example, the case last year with the Secretary General's report on the implementation of Security Council Resolution 1325 of 2000 on women, peace and security, and reports to the General Assembly on violence against women and on eliminating rape and other forms of sexual violence in all their manifestations, including in conflicts and related situations. Your second question, Madam Chair, asks us how are Indigenous youth perspective incorporated into the work of the Secretariat and that of the Division. Now, the Division of Social Policy and Development supports Indigenous youth through the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum, as well as through the UN Program on Youth. From its inception, the Secretariat of the Forum has encouraged youth participation at the session of the Forum. The Indigenous Youth Caucus, which is supported by the Secretariat, the UN Program of Youth, and UNICEF, has constantly been an active voice at the session of the Forum. This was particularly the case at the second session of the Forum, which addressed Indigenous children and youth at this special theme. The Forum, produced a brochure on youth participation as an input to this second session. The UN Program on Youth has addressed the special situation of Indigenous youth in the World Youth Report, including a full chapter on Indigenous youth and climate change in the forthcoming report for 2009. The Program on Youth has also contributed to the growing participation of Indigenous youth in global networks such as Taking IT Global. 24% of the project funded by the Small Grants Program of the second decade from 2006-2008 focus on Indigenous youth. Finally, Madam Chair, you ask us, how does the Secretariat cooperate with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights? So I, for the reason of time, I'll stop here, Madam. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would like now to move on to the speakers list, and I would like to call on Monica Aliman from the International Indigenous Women's Forum. And again, I reiterate that this is meant to ask questions or clarification from the panelists. Is Monica Aliman in the room? She's not in the room. I call on Ferhat Mehini from the Confederation de Association Amasir de Sud Marocain. Yes, you have the floor. Is Ferhat here? Yes, okay.
Thank you. Masat Aselwais, Invgawin Lharman, Mshi Yani Gharfani Menzan, Azul Sour Samuth Nikdailian, Makard Sinwa Wellness Kdailis, this is Matil Jnasi Duklin. أن ليس انتبور أن تذر ثغر أغلانت سنصيفت إوغر فقذيلي مدام لابريزيدانت أونورابل ربزنطان دي ببلز أوتوكتون لببل كابيو
Distinguished chairperson, the Kapio people greet you in their own language to mark their arrival here at the United Nations on Tuesday 2009. As Kapio people, our very existence is being denied, our language is denied us, and there is an ongoing, constant struggle between us and the Algerian government since 1963. I shall not go into all of the details, but there is no tour through years without there being some peaceful uprising and then some bloody crushing of that uprising. And so there is a constant insecurity and military occupation of our land. There is also economic sabotage. And even our crops are damaged. Sometimes military people and the police set fire to our lands. And from 2007 to 2008, over 1.5 million olive trees were burned down and destroyed. These were age-old trees that made up our economy, our well-being, and the health of our people. Vast areas of forest has been set fire to. The authorities have done nothing about it. They have not tried to put out the forest fires. Worse, even when the forest fires reach houses, the authorities stop us from putting them out. It was only when the Kabyle people had driven out the authorities in the spring of 2001 that we were able to put out some of the forest fires. We have been made political prisoners.
Understand your situation, but I would like you to go now if you have specific questions to ask from our panel, please.
We have endorsed all of the resolutions and decisions, including the 2007 declarations on indigenous peoples. So with support from the international community and United Nations bodies, ensuring implementation for the international covenants, we would hope to bring pressure to bear on the Algerian authorities to ensure that the Kabyle people can exercise all of their rights, including regional autonomy throughout the Maghreb. On 20 April last, we had over 20,000 people on a march and a demonstration in support of this. Thank you, madam.
Jorgensen, you have the floor.
Sorry. I have not asked for the floor, so I'll abstain. Thank you.
Okay, that's good. We don't have much time. So we'll have now Nait Sid Kimira from the Caucus Amasig, and I would like you to please not make a statement but focus on points you would like to raise with our panelists. This is a dialogue, so please focus on your questions or comments on what they said. Thank you. You have the floor, Mr. Nait Sid Kimira. Yes, you have the floor. A woman, sorry.
Good morning. The Amazighs have some questions to address to the United Nations bodies and the Permanent Forum. The first one is, how do you intend to work with indigenous NGOs on the ground in the field? How do you intend to help capacity building of indigenous peoples and NGOs? Are you going to visit our lands to see for yourselves what the true situation of indigenous people is? How can you protect the Amazighs and the Kabyles against the policy of assimilation, which is a policy pursued by governments in Northern Africa? And another question, how can ECOSOC and the Permanent Forum deal with the deadlock which has developed? How can you help to promote indigenous peoples in Africa? I have so many questions here. I'm trying to identify and focus on the most relevant ones, if you'll forgive me. Thank you. My colleague will ask the questions from the Tuareg, if that is possible. So the question is, how does ECOSOC and the Permanent Forum intend to protect the rights of indigenous peoples in African countries? Most of the UN system and the United Nations do not even become involved in this area of issues, the categories of rights. Our last question is, how can ECOSOC resolve the deadlock about how to get governments involved in disseminating the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples? NGOs in the diaspora have to be taken into account, as well as the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, how to promulgate.
Thank you very much. I'd like to call now on Les Malizier, who will speak on behalf of the National Native Title Council and other organizations in Australia. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, we appreciate very much the information given by DISA in this session. It's been very informative, and up until now, it's been hard to distinguish the functions of the department apart from the role as Secretariat to the Permanent Forum. Many questions have already been asked, and particularly in relation to what the department is doing in response to Article 42 of the Declaration, and I've listened very carefully to those answers. And I'd like to add to that, in response to Article 42 of the Declaration, in particular Articles 26, I think it's 29, 31 and 32, which relate to Indigenous peoples and our lands and territories, that the programs that run in DISA, what are they doing in relation to those areas of rights that are in there, and if there's more information that is available on that. And specifically, apart from the midterm review on the progress made in the second decade of the world's Indigenous peoples, we'd like to know what else is happening. For example, are governments contributing more since the adoption of the Declaration towards a voluntary fund for the second decade, and how can they be urged to contribute further, and what initiatives are particularly have been undertaken by DISA, which involve the Pacific region and Australia, to promote the Declaration and the Program of Action for the second decade. We welcome the Department's policies to increase participation by Indigenous peoples as peoples in all areas of DISA's mandates, including sustainable development, forest and climate change. What actions and strategies have been and are being implemented in that regard, noting that in CSD in particular, there is only limited participation by Indigenous peoples, should the role of the existing voluntary funds be revised so that we, in fact, can have more people present at those forums? And finally, we ask, that does the department have strategies to increase the employment of Indigenous peoples in both mainstream and specialised positions, and what success has been achieved in those strategies? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Les Malizier. And now I call on the representative of the Observer State of Nicaragua. You have the floor, sir.
Gracias.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson. A specific question. To whom should I address my request that population censuses be carried out of Indigenous peoples along the coast in Nicaragua? To whom should I address my question about population censuses of the Indigenous peoples on the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua? Thank you very much.
Well, this will be addressed to the Division of Statistics, but of course it also should be addressed to your own government, because you are the ones carrying out the census yourselves. So anyway, let me give the members of the panel a chance to respond briefly to the questions that were raised, whatever question you think is something that you can respond to. And I would like to see hands or flags up. Yes, please, the Division of Statistics. Yeah.
Madam Chair, thank you very much, and thank you for the questions. I would just like to add to what Madam Chair already emphasized. The population and housing census is a national exercise, a national statistical exercise. So to answer this specific question, I believe the best address would be the National Statistical Office of Nicaragua, that is organizing and conducting the census. Having said that, I would like really to assure all the members of the forum that the United Nations guidelines for population and housing census are very straightforward, and that they outline the necessity of enumerating every single person within the national boundaries, irrespective of gender, irrespective of ethnicity, or any other personal characteristics such as religion and so on and so forth.
Excuse me, our speaker from Nicaragua was not listening to the response of our representative of the DESA. Anyway, you just continue.
Well, that would be all. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Is there any other? No. Before I call on you, I noticed my colleagues, they also have raised their flags. Can I ask you to also ask very short questions before we move on to them? I'd like to call on Hassan Idbal Kasam, and then after him, Elisa Kankimon.
Madam President, I would like to welcome the dialogue that is being conducted here, and with the attendance of His Excellency the Undersecretary General, as well as the heads of DESA's different divisions. At the outset, Madam Chair, I have listened with interest I've listened to a statement on the National Sorry Day, and I would like to comment on this first, if you don't mind. It is well known that assimilation policies have led to the destruction of the cultures and languages of indigenous nations and have robbed them of their collective rights. It is important for states that have placed assimilation policies here. It is important for these states to follow in the footsteps of states that have apologized to their indigenous nations for these policies. I would also like to thank the speakers who spoke this morning for presenting analyses that are very important on indigenous people's issues. My question pertains to several of these issues, and my first remark is that the adoption of the declaration requires an increase in the budgets allocated to indigenous peoples' issues in your establishment or in this forum. Moreover, the adoption of the declaration has created new tasks. For example, those related to indigenous women's issues. While we know that there are some small projects to support women throughout the world, and I affirm here that my country has a clear example of this, such as partnerships for women, at the same time, there are major projects that are handed over to multinational companies without the consent of these women, and especially indigenous women, which destroys all their capacities and capabilities. So what is being done there? Another question is about youth, the World Youth Forum. The adoption of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, will this enable the youth to receive new grants for education in fields that are specialized and within the programs that have been initiated for this within the UN? Moreover, as for sustainable policy, development policy, and development policies in general, do you have any plans to implement this slogan that is the second international decade for indigenous peoples in the framework of partnership? Is there any kind of planning on how to educate countries and indigenous peoples on creating partnerships between them in governance and in resource management and in values? I thank you.
Hassan, I'd like to call now on Elisa Kankimolo. You have the floor.
Gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. We appreciate DESA's participation in this constructive dialogue with Indigenous peoples. The forum and the work done in recent years have had what I would call a powerful impact on policies at all levels in the system. However, the operational activities at the country level is still a matter of concern to us, to Indigenous people. I wonder if DESA has a long-term program or plan on decentralizing the office of the forum, or is there any plan to set up country offices for the permanent forum, or will we continue with the focal points who do not actually have a huge influence? Thank you.
I'd like now to move to our panelists and also request them to be as brief as possible so we can move to the next agency. Yes, Mr. Yes, you have the floor.
First, the question from of the member of the forum asked, an observer asked, how does the department promote the employment of Indigenous persons? Let me answer on behalf of the Secretariat. I mean, as you know, personal policies at the UN are set by the General Assembly, and the UN Secretariat departments follow those policies. However, within those parameters, the department has, whenever possible, employ Indigenous persons in the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum. From the establishment of the Secretariat in 2003 to date, four Indigenous persons have been employed as staff of the Secretariat in geographical posts, in addition to some 20 Indigenous consultants who have been employed for specific projects. And under the internship program of the United Nations, the department has placed 10 Indigenous persons in the Secretariat. And in 2008, and in cooperation with a member of the Interagency Support Group on Indigenous Issues, the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum prepared a database of Indigenous experts available to work in the UN system. And the department also welcomed the initiative of the international labor organizations to conduct a study on the challenges and opportunity for employment of Indigenous persons in the UN system. And we look forward to cooperating with the ILO on these studies. Finally, DESA hopes that an increasing number of Indigenous persons will be joining the staff of the UN system at headquarters and in the field. Let me add briefly also that as far as the voluntary fund is concerned, a number of small grants are given to projects submitted by Indigenous organizations from Africa. As for the decade, our division hopes to be able to cooperate with the government to organize an expert group meeting for the mid-decade review sometime next year. Questions were asked also about engaging governments on the declaration. I mean, and our division is planning to launch a capacity development program on the declaration available to all governments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Yes, please. You have.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Answering the other question on the operational problems that have been found in several countries to access policy matters related with indigenous peoples. In the Division for Public Administration, we would be glad to conduct some research together with some of you being represented here today on what works and what doesn't work in different contexts. If we can meet later after this dialogue, we can engage very gladly in some talks to see how we can serve you with some research in this field to propagate knowledge on good practices. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. As you may well know, there are representatives here of Indigenous peoples from local government who are members of the local government, as well as indigenous parliamentarians. And so it would really be good if indigenous people also are engaged in the local government level, can get in touch with the Department of Public Administration, because I do think they can help in providing technical assistance also on for indigenous peoples, especially because for many, this is not something that's that they have experienced for a long time. These are new experiences considering the increased strength of indigenous peoples' movements all over the world. Is there any other member of the panel who would like to take the floor? Yes, please.
I would just like to reinforce what you said earlier about our interest in the Division for Sustainable Development in cooperating with the Permanent Forum and with indigenous communities in the next cycle of our commission's work, where we will be looking at issues which are also very relevant to you. And I would welcome meeting some of you later who are particularly knowledgeable about such issues as mining and the management of the revenues of mining, negotiation with mining companies, the generally all of the issues surrounding mining and indigenous communities. Perhaps we can even think about some collaboration in publication or whatever. And similarly, in the area of sustainable consumption and production, where indigenous communities have, of course, important knowledge to share with the rest of us about sustainable consumption and production. But more generally, we welcome cooperating with you, and we hope we can bring more representatives of indigenous communities to the CSD next time around. We'll certainly work on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. As I mentioned, this is really a very relevant issue for most indigenous people who are here, and that's the reason why the Permanent Forum decided to have an expert group meeting this year on that issue. And I'm sure it will be really very helpful if we can explore ways in which indigenous peoples can really actively participate in deciding how the particular session can be shaped. And we're also going to have a side event on May 28 on extractive industries, where the members of the Indigenous Peoples Global Network on Indigenous Peoples and Extractive Industries will also participate, and they will present the result of the International Conference on Indigenous Peoples and Extractive Industries, which was held prior to the expert group meeting. We think that this is a way in which they can really explore ways to engage more actively and fruitfully with the Commission on Sustainable Development and the Division on Sustainable Development. Okay, is there any other member of the forum? Is Elsa wanting to say something? Okay. I would like to first thank, I really warmly thank all the division heads and representatives and staff of the DESA, and of course to Undersecretary Mr. Shah Sukang, as well as Assistant Secretary General Mr. Jomo Sundaram. We will be having him again, I think, on the 27th on the panel on economic crisis and impacts on indigenous peoples. And so this is not the last time that we will be having some representatives of DESA, but I think this has been a very useful dialogue, because truly many indigenous peoples don't understand what DESA is. No, they only know the secretariat, but they don't know that under DESA you have the Division on Advancement of Women, the UN Forum on Forests, the Division on Sustainable Development, as well as the Division on Statistics, and of course the Division of Public Administration, among others. These are really very key divisions for all our issues that we have been raising here constantly, you know? And if you remember, even on statistics, one of our first expert group meetings was really on disaggregated data for indigenous peoples, because we have identified at the very outset that we cannot really do targeted programs if we don't even know where indigenous peoples are found, what is their situation, and what are the problems they face in terms of making themselves visible in a country, you know. And we always believe that the statistics is one of the instruments that will really allow this kind of visibility for indigenous peoples all over the world. And therefore, I'm personally, I'm so happy that we finally got the Division of Statistics to speak before us. We also know that all the issues in being dealt with in the sustainable development area, in the forest area, as well as on women, of course, are all key issues for us, and we are wanting to explore further how we can really work together around this issue of climate change and biological diversity and cultural diversity, because these are the issues that will come strongly into the fore as we are going towards Copenhagen, the Conference of Parties 15 of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And next year, as you may know, our theme is development with indigenous peoples, development with culture and identity, focusing on Articles 3, the article on the right to self-determination, on Articles 32, the article on the right to development of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. This is an opportunity for us to be able to bring into the picture all the different views and perspectives and practices of indigenous peoples in trying to shape their own development visions as well as their development perspectives. And I think this will really feed in very neatly with all the other areas that you will be talking about in the next sessions, in your own sessions, the sessions of the commissions that you are servicing. So let me thank you all again, and we look forward to forging this kind of partnership and relationship. And I assure you that maybe after this, there will be lots of people who will be running after you to get some more details about the things that you have mentioned here. This, I know that what you have mentioned are just the tip of the iceberg. There is still much more to see as we dig deeper, and this will be really opportunities for us to be able to strengthen that kind of partnership, which, after all, is the theme of the second decade of the world's indigenous people. So thank you very much, and we will move on now to the next agency, which is the International Fund on Agricultural Development. But before I let IFAD speak, I just would like to let one indigenous representative speak. But let me ask the representatives of IFAD, Jean-Paul Odine and Antonella Cordone, to please come into the podium. Thank you very much. Let's give the DESA a round of applause for this dialogue. Thank you. Okay. Sorry. While we are asking Ms. Antonella Cordone to come here, I would like to give the floor briefly to the representative of CONAMAC in Bolivia, Elias Kelqua, to make a very brief statement. Is Elias Kelqua in the room? Are you in the room or no? Yeah, okay, you have the floor, sir. Please speak very briefly while we are... Yes, you have the floor. You press your button.
First of all, I wish to thank my sister in the chair and her assistants who are present here and who are leading the permanent forum. My name is Elias Kalkamamane, and I come from the National Council of Corazon Coramac. I come from Bolivia, and I speak Aymara as my language. However, in order for all of us to have this knowledge, I will have to speak in Spanish. Actually, the opinions of all indigenous peoples is free, and we're free to express our views at this meeting. It is very important that we have followed all the reports that have been presented. That is on the one hand. On the other hand, we have heard claims on given the level of violence and the discrimination which we continuously feel. Therefore, we as indigenous peoples here from CONAMAC originally, we want to make it known that Our process has to do with rebuilding what we have had together with all the original indigenous authorities. To this end, we need to rebuild and for this purpose to have the necessary funds. I was listening to the report on funding and the funds that have been allocated to various activities, but in actual practice and as part of the process, these funds do not reach to the same extent as stated in the report. What we say is that we not only need to rebuild and to follow the development process and to ensure that it is productive, but for all of this to happen, we request that funding reach the original indigenous peoples directly so that we can conduct our activities. At times, a report mentions everything that is being done, but we cannot do everything we want to do with few funds. We want to be able to carry out many activities. This is a claim and a request that we would have to put before you for your consideration. Also, we also claim our rights to self-determination, the right to live freely, free from violence, a right to property, and an adequate standard of living. We claim a right to culture, and this is what we request. We will listen to speeches so long as things are translated into practice, and we thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Elias Cuelca from Honamac in Bolivia. And yes, you please try to listen because our next agency is the International Fund on Agricultural Development, who are really providing resources for developing countries in particular, and we would like to hear the report regarding the work that they are doing with indigenous peoples. So I would like to welcome Mr. Jean-Paul Audinet, who is the director for the policy division of IFAD, and Ms. Antonella Cordoni, who is a member of his staff. And I would like to give the floor now to Mr. Audinet, and then we will also listen to the other people that they would like to speak in relation to the work that they are doing. Mr. Audinet, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson, dear Vicky, distinguished members of the Permanent Forum, distinguished delegates, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning. My name is not Jean-Paul. My name is Jean-Philippe.
Jean-Philippe. I'm sorry.
It's really a honor for me and a pleasure to here represent IFAD at this session of the Forum. And we are grateful, together with my colleagues Antonella Cordone and Xenia von Lilien, who represent IFAD in New York, we are grateful for this opportunity provided to us to have with you this in-depth dialogue on our engagement with indigenous peoples. For an institution like IFAD, who is engaged on people-centered, equitable, and sustainable development, the challenge that indigenous peoples are facing are not at the periphery, but at the center of the development agenda. This is particularly the case for IFAD because of our exclusive focus on rural communities and rural livelihoods, and a particular focus on poor women and men in these communities. When you search for poor rural communities in Asia, Africa, or Latin America, most of the time, what you find is an indigenous people community. In IFAD's strategic framework, indigenous peoples are singled out as a specific target group for the work of the fund that deserve a specific attention and approach. Indigenous peoples all over the world generally are often marginal players in policy making about their own developments. They lack voice, or they used to lack voice, and they are getting more voice. And obviously, the theme of today, the first theme on the question regarding the UN declaration, is a typical case of this strengthened voice that you finally are getting. For an organization like us, addressing the specific needs of indigenous people and their own effort to overcome poverty is a key policy and operational challenge. Meeting it requires first to recognize the multidimensional and the diversity of poverty and powerlessness and the different form of subjugation, marginalization, or dispossession that poor people experience. Second, it requires us to build on the strengths and value of indigenous peoples, to build on their distinctiveness as an asset for their own economic and social development. In the report we have submitted to the forum, there is a detailed overview on IFAD engagement with indigenous peoples, and the report submitted to the forum in the past years contains more information on projects and activities. However, let me highlight a few issues, and I would like to start with a short overview of IFAD. Indeed, I've been told that despite the fact that IFAD is participating in this forum for now 7 years, actually, many people participating in the forum actually don't know what IFAD is. And maybe one of the reasons is that IFAD doesn't have offices or formal representation in the countries, and therefore for you who come from your respective countries, maybe you didn't have the opportunity to actually speak and meet IFAD staff who are most of them based in our headquarters in Rome. We work with partners in countries, government and civil societies, and we are a fund, so basically our basic function is to actually provide financial resources to these partners for their development. This being said, more and more, we will have permanent representatives in the countries, and we will have more opportunity to meet at country level. IFAD is the International Fund for Agricultural Development of the United Nations. It is an international financial institution, and it is also a specialized agency of the United Nations system. Its mandate is to support developing countries in their effort to eradicate poverty and hunger in rural areas. I recall that three-quarters of the world, 1.4 billion extremely poor people, live in rural areas of developing countries. Who are they? They are small farmers, fisher folks, pastoralists and herders, landless rural workers, artisans, hunters and gatherers, and many of them are indigenous peoples. The objective of IFAD is to enable poor people, women and men, to access and take advantage of natural resources, land and water, improve agricultural technologies and production services, financial services in rural areas, access to market for their product and inputs, access to rural off-farm employment and enterprise development, and finally, but very importantly,
access to local and national policy and programming processes. These are the six strategic objectives in our strategic framework. IFAD has 30 years of existence now, and over these 30 years, we have approved and financed almost 800 development projects. I'm talking about what we call the typical loan project, something like $10 to $30 million for 5 to 10 years of activities, for a total investment of about $10 billion US dollars, supporting more than 300 million people living in poverty in 115 developing countries and territories. In the way we work, and I said it before, because we are not present in the countries and we are certainly not implementing any of these projects, for us, partnership is fundamental. We work with others. First of all, we work with our members, who are the governments of our member countries. We work with rural communities and rural people's organization, including farmers' organization, indigenous people's organization, rural women organization, and others. We work, obviously, with our sister agencies in the UN system and the other international financial institutions. We work with NGOs, civil society, and also with agricultural research centers, in particular the centers who are part of the CGIRs. This is what IFAD is. Since our inception in 1978, IFAD has been supporting through loans, which are our main instrument, and also some grants, we have been supporting indigenous people's community living very often in remote rural areas, in mountain, in desert, in forest. And this has been a fundamental part of our mandate to reduce and hopefully eradicate rural poverty and hunger. During the first decades of IFAD works, however, indigenous peoples were not acknowledged and targeted in a specific or differentiated way. They were considered as part of the rural poor people. But with time and experience on the ground, IFAD has gained a deeper understanding of indigenous people's issues. And with time, and particularly over the last 10 years, the institution recognized that while indigenous peoples are indeed very much represented and part of the rural poor people, they have a difference, they have their own difference, their own identity, and also they have their own natural and cultural assets in their history, in their culture and identity. Our engagement with indigenous peoples can be divided in three main pillars. The first one and the most important for a financial institution is our projects and program at country level that are part of what we call our country program. This country program being guided first by the national policy framework and the development objective of countries, and also guided by our own IFAD's corporate policies. We are currently, for the first time after 30 years, developing a corporate policy on engagement with indigenous peoples, and I will come back to this. The second part of our engagement is our role as advocacy and policy dialogue at international, regional, and national level. And finally, we have a third, much more recent, but very interesting instrument that are very small grants that we provide directly to indigenous peoples' communities at grassroots level through an instrument I will talk about later called the Indigenous Peoples Assistance Facility. On the part, the second part of this, which is the advocacy role at international level, let me just remember a few activities. Following our participation in the World Summit on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg, we established a strong partnership with the forum. and also with the UN interagency group supporting the forum. We have been part of this group very actively from the beginning, and we have been supporting the forum also from this time. The partnership with the forum and the interagency support group have been instrumental in mainstreaming indigenous people's issue within our own organization and helped us a lot learning from the experience of others. We deeply value these partnerships. IFAD has been supporting the work of the forum through grants and has so far provided 3 grants to the forum secretariat for a total amount of $500,000. We have been partnering with indigenous people's organization and supporting their institution. For example, by February 2008, the fund, IFAD, provided institutional grants for a total amount of $1 million, to support advocacy and policy work, and in response to the forum's recommendation on issues related to indigenous women, the assessment of the first international decade of the world indigenous peoples in Asia, to mobile indigenous peoples' communications for development, identity, powers and rights, spatial and cultural mapping, and climate change issues. Let me elaborate briefly on our core business, our loans and grant program at country level. Over the past 6 years, we made this assessment recently, over the past 6 years, about 20%, actually a little more than 20% of our lending resources, our loans to government, have been benefiting directly to indigenous peoples and indigenous peoples' territories. There are currently 91 projects, ongoing projects in 27 countries working with indigenous peoples, 33 in Asia, 40 in Latin America and the Caribbean, and 18 in Africa. IFAD funded projects over the years have addressed a number of issues of importance for indigenous peoples: securing access to ancestral lands and territories, promoting in a culturally sensitive way indigenous women's capacity for autonomous action in community affairs, something very important for IFAD, who has a major engagement with women and rural women, enhancing indigenous people's livelihood through sustainable natural resource management, being on rangeland or fisheries or agriculture, valuing and revitalizing indigenous knowledge systems and blending them with modern technology. I was referring before to our support to Agricultural Research Center. In this framework, we work very much trying to blend these two worlds of knowledge, the scientific modern language and the traditional knowledge of indigenous peoples. We have been supporting bilingual and cross-cultural education and promoting intercultural awareness. We have been strengthening indigenous people's institutions and their judicial systems, enhancing indigenous identity and self-esteem, and fostering culturally based micro-enterprise. In these many, many projects and programs on the ground, there have been obviously success and failures. We have conducted in-depth desk reviews of our project, and particularly we have conducted desk review of the portfolio of projects with indigenous peoples in Latin America and the Caribbean region in 2007, and also we started one of such assessment in Asia in 2008. This one, which is still ongoing, have highlighted that more systematic efforts need to be made in our work with indigenous peoples through project and program on the following area. First of all, secure access to land and territories, particularly in views of the increasing threats to indigenous lands and territories from outsiders for extraction of subsoil resource or indeed land grabbing for large-scale plantations, including for biofuels and others, large-scale plantations that have been increasing very much over the last 2-3 years. Secondly, we have to do more in systematically accompanying indigenous peoples in documenting their own best practice to cope with, adapt to, and mitigate the adverse effect of climate change. This is a major challenge and will be over the future decades a major challenge faced by the humanity in general, but particularly with people depending on natural resources and indigenous peoples in particular. We have to do more also in support to local seeds conservation efforts to promote niche products and identify products to be protected with designation of origin. There are others, but these are the three on which we consider that more has to be done. Overall, in its experience on the ground, IFAD has learned that development strategies with indigenous peoples need to be guided by a holistic vision that includes economic growth, empowerment, sustainable management of natural resources, and recognition and protection of social, economic, and cultural rights. To implement this vision, it is therefore necessary to recognize that enabling indigenous people to escape poverty requires respect for their rights, respect for their specific culture and traditions, and respect for their own aspirations to control their destiny. It is within this perspective and with the aim of providing IFAD with an instrument to systematize its good practice and approaches that IFAD policy on engagement with indigenous people is being developed today. Under IFAD's overall missions to enable rural poor people to overcome poverty, this policy will aim at enhancing IFAD's ability to empower indigenous people to engage in self-development process. This policy will be submitted for approval to the executive boards of IFAD in September this year. It has been already discussed in an informal seminar with our board members in April. It is worth noting, still on the policy front, that in 2008, IFAD executive board approved a policy on improving access to land and tenure security. And in this policy, among the few fundamental guiding principles, there is one including the adherence to the principle of free, prior, and informed consent. Therefore, free, prior, and informed consent on investment project or development activities that may affect access to land and tenure security, this free, prior, and informed consent is now already part of IFAD policy. The policy states that this principle of free, prior, and informed consent is of particular importance for most indigenous peoples, tribal peoples, and ethnic minorities who have cultural distinctive land tenure regime based on collective rights to land and territories. Recognition of this regime and rights is often incomplete, leading to social and political marginalization and land grabbing by powerful stakeholders. Mechanisms for securing indigenous people's rights to their lands are important for their cultural survival and better livelihoods prospects. Finally, I will briefly present this third element, let's say, of our engagement or instrument in our engagement with indigenous people, which is the Indigenous People's Assistance Facility. In addition to projects approved through our big loans and grants, IFAD has established a special, much smaller facility. We call it IPAF, the Indigenous People Assistance Facility, that support directly self-determined development of indigenous peoples' communities and of indigenous peoples' organizations. This facility was transferred in 2006 from the World Bank, and I thank here Naveen, that I see here representing the bank, who has actually been very instrumental in this transfer. This facility is demand-driven and provides grants of the dimension between $10,000 and $30,000 to small projects designed and implemented by indigenous peoples' communities at grassroots level. The facility is governed by a board composed of 4 indigenous peoples' leaders, including the chair of the UN Permanent Forum. I will name also Myrna Cunningham, Wolde Tadese, Kiram Nongi Green, and also in the board 2 IFAD staff. The facility is managed through a bidding process following a call for proposal. All eligible applications received by the deadlines are reviewed and rated according to project relevance, feasibility, institutional capacity, and institutional credibility. In 2008, the technical review process of these many proposals was conducted with the support of indigenous peoples' experts. During the past 2 years of implementation, this facility has funded 73 microprojects in 47 countries worldwide. This small facility represents an additional opportunity for IFAD to work with indigenous peoples directly, not through government, and this is a major difference, contrary to our big loans and grants that are part of country programs discussed and approved and owned by country governments. The small grants of the Indigenous Peoples Assistance Facility goes directly to Indigenous Peoples groups and communities, which creates for IFAD the capacity to link with actually you on the ground. In the facility is financially supported by some partners. It has been supported at the beginning by the World Bank, but also by the governments of Norway, of Canada, Finland, and Italy. The 30 projects approved in 2007 were implemented in 2008 with about 500 communities of 50 different indigenous peoples worldwide, reaching more than 27 direct beneficiaries and above 30,000 indirect beneficiaries. The second call for proposal in 2008 have delivered 43 projects in 33 countries for a total amount of $900,000, which is a 50% increase over the previous round. While financing this micro project, this facility is also, for us, a way to learn about the needs and the solutions expressed directly by indigenous people's organizations. It's also a way to scout for innovation. And this learning and innovation part is certainly an important function of the facility on top of the purely financial aspect of it. In this framework of, in this context of learning, a research study was conducted in the more than 1,000 project proposals received in 2007. The study focused on solutions to rural poverty and sectors of intervention as proposed by indigenous peoples' communities themselves. I would like, Ms. Chair, to, as we discuss or present this Indigenous Peoples' Assistance Facility, to give the floor briefly to Tarsila Rivera and Florina Lopez, who are leading organizations that have been receiving, that have been proposing projects and that have been receiving fundings. If Tarsila is from Peru and Florina from Panama, if they could give us and share with us very briefly their impression of this facility and what it has served in their own process of development. and I will conclude after
yes,
that.
Yes, Tarsila, you have the floor.
Muy buenos días, hermanas y hermanos.
Good morning to everybody. I'd like to thank you all very much for giving us this opportunity to speak briefly about how important it is for people and small communities and organizations to be able to meet together in one place and this is not just a question of getting us all together with state intervention, but actually the indigenous women of Peru are made up of 30 organizations of Amazonian and Indian women, and we meet together regularly. We want to ensure implementation of the law on traditional law and biodiversity. This is quite an old law in Peru. And we have two organizations, one from the Central Sierra, the Ashinika people, and there are 12 federations in that group, and also with the Quechua people in another province, which also has 12 districts. And we also participate with local organizations and community women's organizations. We have learned that much knowledge about biodiversity has been registered by third parties without the knowledge of the communities. Applying a national law, which is made up of legal concepts, is difficult because sometimes the legal concepts are unknown to our people. So there is a need to codify and to provide special support so that people of the community can understand and apply these laws, and also we need people with knowledge of the local languages. Also, we need a way of conveying information about this national law to the local people so it can be applied in practice. However, so far we've had some wonderful results, because the Ashinika and Quechua peoples are already now aware that there is this law in existence which can in fact be applied. Also, we know that we are the owners of our traditional knowledge. Of course, the information is available freely, but we also have to learn new ways of defending our right to our knowledge at the national level. Of course, as citizens, we also have rights and duties. So, we've had some rather wonderful developments, and we support this initiative, but we would like to urge the donors to the fund to continue making contributions, because in fact this fund is the only way in which funds are directly made available so that further initiatives can be undertaken so as to strengthen our own initiatives at the community level. The fund seems quite substantial, but it's never been possible to follow up on all of our projects. And so it's never enough. So we are still working on the problems that exist in our community. So I would take this opportunity to urge you all to ensure that the fund continue to grow, that we can develop our own initiatives. Thank you very much.
I'd like now to give the floor to Florina Lopez from PAN.
Bueno, muchas gracias. En primer lugar, muy buenas.
Thank you very much. I am from the Kuna people of Panama. Following up from what has just been said, I would like to talk about how indigenous organizations can have access at the state level, because very often indigenous peoples are not sure how to get access to certain funds or to the state level, and they require legal assistance. So for us, particularly for the Kuna people, the fund has been directly useful to us. We help to get cooperation on traditional knowledge, particularly on seeds, which we have traditionally used, because often these are now becoming less used and lost from our territories. But we as indigenous peoples are sometimes not sure about how many seeds, what the numbers are of seeds that are being lost. This is one of the challenges for us. And also, indigenous women are now being involved in this project, because in the Kunai people, it is the indigenous women It is not the indigenous women that work in the fields. It's the men in our community who work in the fields. It's a particularity of our people. And, of course, there have been changes in the past. However, now our women are taking up this challenge. Sometimes the men don't want to work in the fields. They want to be involved in other activities. And so now the women and mothers have taken this initiative and have made this proposal for this particular project to the fund. As indigenous women, we are exchanging our experiences among the 6 communities where the project is being carried out. We are trying to understand to what extent our seeds are being lost and how we can recuperate them, how we can work with these seedlings. Many men, young men in our communities, when they realize that women are going to be working in the fields, the men come and help us and offer their support. And so we support this idea of their helping us in the fields because they don't have practice. They don't have experience in this. And so, in fact, this was a really successful outcome of seeing how our project had an impact on men's becoming more involved in working in the fields. They had been feeling that their masculinity had been being undermined and that women were taking over from them. But now the men also have become more involved, and they feel much more involved in our project. Then there's also another project on Kuna art and the Moles Poblano. And in fact, tourism is entering our communities, and this is economic revenue for the women. It's financial income. There was a question of young women and girls not being involved in the Kuna art, but now they are becoming more involved in the communities and they have become part of this activity. So this was really good for us to see that girls and young women were willing to learn this art, our tradition, because regardless of how we look at formal education, we do want our girls to learn our traditional knowledge, our traditional art, so that during their leisure time, they can, in fact, develop their traditional knowledge and skills and art. So this project has helped the various communities interact with each other more, and also women are now participating more and offering leadership. And moreover, our men are also becoming more involved, so that all of our traditional knowledge is preserved and not lost. There's also the question of increased additional financial support being needed. We want to expand the project so that even more communities become involved. But it's been a very slow process because of the need for additional funding. However, we have been working on this, and we would like to urge those who contribute to the fund to continue to do so, so that the fund can grow and our women will also have an opportunity for finding some kind of financial revenue. And we would like to ensure that the project develop further and become a main focus for us. So we would like to extend our thanks to those involved in the fund, and we trust the fund will continue to grow. Thank you.
Now to go back to Jean-Philippe to make his conclusions on more. Okay.
No, it's just to say
okay.
Thank you, and I apologize for the long presentation, yeah. And looking forward for your question and answer, okay. Because this is a dialogue.
Okay, we have our colleagues who are assigned to do this, and these are Elisa Kanki-Molo and Margaret Lokawa. So, Elisa, you have the floor.
Gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. We are very grateful to all the participants being here with us today, making a contribution to the dialogue between Indigenous peoples and the agencies. I want to offer a few very general comments before asking specific questions. One point made at the beginning was how to learn the specific features of the different Indigenous peoples and the ways that they operate. I would have liked to have heard also some reference to the specific relationship between the Indigenous peoples and the market. We have that kind of relationship, and we would like to suggest that perhaps you could also learn from how we interact with the market. So production strategies do not just involve traditional practices. Rather, these are practices that have helped us get to where we are now. If you look back at the 70s, our revolution and the strategies we developed, and there was a discourse at the time about technology offering all of the answers, that new kinds of production strategies would overcome and eliminate poverty among rural communities and Indigenous communities. But nobody talked about how the Indigenous peoples were in fact able to survive, because we penetrated the markets in the cities, in the big cities. We developed our own strategies, and we were able to produce. We produced foods, and they were needed in the local communities, so we were into the local markets as well. So if we look at the experience of the two projects, which were explained very briefly, I think it's important that the initiatives of indigenous peoples be taken and used as a kind of foundation for looking at some new way of interacting with the states, the governments. Our production strategies, our interaction with the markets, the way that the indigenous peoples have operated and survived, this is often not taken into account. And so through this specific fund, I think it would be helpful if it were to do this. So perhaps your specialists could look at the lessons learned and see how use could be made of our practices in the programs that governments are coming to you. I'm not talking about $10,000, $20,000. I'm talking about what you can contribute for specific programs and projects in the future. So to turn now to the questions. May I ask what is the impact of the declaration in your work? September 2007, have things changed since then, or is everything just the same in your organization? And then, are there any specific recommendations for implementation of Article 42, for the recommendations? I know that you've been very supportive of us. Then the framework 2027 and 2010 singles out indigenous people.
Principal target group. So you mentioned in the report something about that, but please assess the impact of having indigenous people as a target group or not. The country strategic opportunity programs is an important strategic framework for planning and result-based monitoring with IFAD. The question here is, how is the policy on the engagement with indigenous peoples to be reflected in the strategic planning on country level? Is there a plan for the revision of the COSOPS framework? Do the COSOP, when establishing results and indicators, have a focus on indigenous issues? If is yes, so please give us examples. We want to know the specific, if you have it, of course. Please elaborate on the statement COSOP that have specifically addressed indigenous issues, including Honduras, Panama, Belize, Mexico, Bolivia, Brazil, and Guatemala. I am referring on the report which we sent us before. More studies, a specific project, indigenous specialists inside of IFAD. What are you referring on the, when you talk about the, you are addressing the indigenous issue on those countries? Thank you.
Margaret, we have a few minutes left before the interpreters will have to go. Margaret, please.
I want to commend the presentations of the staff of IFAD. I know IFAD is one of the facility grants that support indigenous peoples, and we wish that you continue supporting the indigenous peoples. I have some few questions to forward to you for some explanations so that the indigenous peoples understand better of IFAD's work. My questions are as follows. One, in IFAD's strategic framework, one of the main elements in its strategy is to foster and enable local and national policy and programming processes. And as a specific result is enabling policy frameworks, including poverty reduction strategies and sector policies that respond to the needs of the poor rural people. How does IFAD in its partnership with governments and national programs secure the inclusion of indigenous issues and peoples into national policy formulation processes? How does the organization secure the implementation of the prior and informed consent with the partners on national and on local level? The next question is, on a central focus of IFAD in its facilitation of small-scale business and microcredit possibilities, how does IFAD approach the issue of common ownership of indigenous peoples' resources when issuing microcredit, taking into consideration the individual land titling is often a prerequisite and criteria for obtaining microcredit and commercial loans? Will its new policy on engagement with indigenous peoples provide a revision of policies on credit and access tenure security to land? How does IFAD ensure equal distribution of projects in all regions to indigenous peoples organizations, taking into account equality and gender balance? According to the report, the report of 2007-2008, the lowest was being Africa. One of the major challenges of indigenous peoples is high illiteracy rates. When I talk of Africa, which stands at about 70 to 80%, which is a barrier to communication accessibility, among others. What are IFAD's plans in its current policies to overcome this challenge and improve the lives of indigenous peoples? IFAD in its report mentions a range of good practices and examples guaranteed in specific programs and activities implemented on indigenous area. For example, the Warao project in Venezuela, where the design process is highlighted. Another example mentioned is the forest income generating project in India, the Gum Karaya initiative, where the modern techniques were combined with traditional knowledge. How does IFAD promote the scaling up of these relatively isolated pilot projects and experiences? And how does the agency secure the transfer of knowledge within the organization? This question is also relevant in relation to the transfer and capacity building of the UNDG guidelines. Please elaborate on the specific project support by IFAD to promote valuing and revitalization indigenous knowledge systems and blending them with modern technology. Please assess the sustainability of indigenous people's facility and the way forward. Is there any focus or attempt to link the micro-project grants to the large IFAD projects? Announcing the statement delivered by Ms. Oslo during the UN Permanent Forum of the 7th session, IFAD was exploring the scope of establishing a forum for dialogue with indigenous peoples to share ideas and experiences and to make their voices heard, not least in development of country strategies and IFAD-funded projects and programs. What experiences does IFAD possess at present in entering into dialogue with indigenous peoples? Please provide some examples if there is time. And what are the future perspectives regarding a forum for dialogue with indigenous peoples? Thank you. You can answer the ones you feel have not been touched. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to my dear colleagues, distinguished members of the forum, Elisa Kangkimolo and Margaret Lukawa. We don't have time for the responses yet. We are coming back at 3 o'clock to listen to the responses from our colleagues and also to open the floor to the members of the plenary who have wished that they would like to speak. So let me thank Jean-Philippe Odine and Antonella Cordone and request them to be back here at 3 o'clock this afternoon so that we can continue this discussion. This meeting is adjourned. There is a side event here on here. It's room 4. Yeah, exactly. Side event on Indigenous Peoples and Community Conserved Areas and Territories here in this room at 1:15.
Is it time?
Hello.
Secular.
Hello.
Hi.
So.
Yes. Good afternoon, everyone. I can hear myself. Can you hear me too? Too loud? Okay. This is a session on indigenous conservation territories and community conserved areas, which is sponsored by... can't you hear? I don't know what to do about it, which is sponsored by the Small Grants Program of Jeff UNDP, as well as IUCN's Commission on Environmental, Economic and Social Policy, and the ICCA Consortium, and some of its indigenous peoples members or organizations, including WAMIP, which is the World Alliance of Mobile Indigenous Peoples, IPAC, the Indigenous Peoples Africa Coordinating Committee. I'd like to present my co-chair for the session. That is Madame Sarah Fortuné. She's a Tuareg from Niger, and she is in charge of the Association Internationale Tuareg, the International Association of the Tuareg People. And I'll let her introduce me.
Okay. I introduce you. Peut-être que je vais parler en français, oui. Ce sera mieux. Tagui Farva, qui est le secrétaire général de WAMIP, Alliance mondiale des peuples autochtones mobiles, qui vient d'un peuple nomade autochtone, Chazévan, dans l'Azerbaïdjan, Iran.
Merci, Sarah. Thank you. I'd like to right away go into the first presentation. The structure is that we will have an introduction to just what are ICCAs and why indigenous peoples should care about them or why they do. And we will follow that with some notes from Nigel Crowhall, who's just coming back from the IUCN Commission on World Commission on Protected Areas. I would like to say that because we'd like to keep some time for discussion at the end, a substantial time, we would like, as co-chairs, to be very tough by requesting very kindly and sweetly everybody to stick to their time. The first, she's already threatening with this, and she won't be hitting it here. She'll probably be hitting it on my head.
You're already 5 minutes.
Okay, there is Dr. Grazia Borrini Feyerabend and Jorge Nahuel, who will be making the first presentation.
Parece que esta presentación nada mejor que presentarlo con la palabra de un antiguo,
pero más alto,
una antigua autoridad indígena que habla de que no es posible proyectar la vida y la cultura si no es mirando hacia atrás. Y la frase que él menciona es que la flecha siempre va a recorrer una mayor distancia en la medida que podamos tensarlo lo más posible hacia atrás, y esa es la filosofía que los pueblos indígenas practican, de proyectar su vida a partir de reafirmarse en su historia y en su cosmovisión.
about natural resources, and the main actors about natural resources have been human communities. Human communities as hunter-gatherers, herders, peasants, the people who have built the terraces and the water channels that allowed the utilization of natural resources throughout the world. In fact, many communities did create themselves around the management of certain bodies of natural resources. We say this in short by saying that cultural diversity and biological diversity evolved together.
Just a second. Sorry, I see some people struggling with the things. The channels for English will change depending on what language is being spoken. So if you can't find it, just switch your channels so you can find English.
No, it doesn't. It keeps always the same. Okay. In fact, not only communities managed their natural resources, in many places they even enriched the local biodiversity through what is called today agrobiodiversities. They did so in many ways, including by promoting habitat connectivities and creating new habitat for species. This is true for both marine and terrestrial environments throughout the world. And in the marine environment, you find many instances of conservation practices as in the terrestrial environment, which is not often considered to be true. This wealth of traditions and practices that spans the whole world has been very poorly recognized by the official conservation establishment until quite recently. In fact, for a long time, conservation was supposed to do with separating people from resources. The very term protected areas tells you that nature needs to be protected from people, and especially when people are poor and dependent on those resources for their livelihood. Well, in some very nice cases, you would have that indigenous peoples and local communities were called to participate in conservation, but while the decisions and the action of conservation remained firmly in the hands of professional experts helped by the military for surveillance and repression. This encountered lots of resistance, as you well know, throughout the world, but in terms of international policies, things began to change only with CBD in 1992. But more specifically, in terms of protected areas, real change had to wait until the beginning of this millennium. And two events were particularly important for that change. The 5th World Parks Congress in Durban, 2003, and the immediately following CBD Program of Work on Protected Areas in 2004. In these two events, finally, we see that there is an emphasis on the capacities and the roles of indigenous peoples and local communities for conservation as actors. The key messages of these events are very simple. First, conservation needs to respect human rights. It has to do no harm, but also have a positive impact whenever possible. Second, conservation cannot be done without equity, a fair sharing of the costs and the benefits of conservation itself. Third, we have to pay much stronger attention to the ties that pull together biological and cultural diversities. And this is nothing less than requiring that communities, the communities that live and evolve with the resources, are empowered in conservation practice. All this can be encapsulated by one important concept that really came to the fore at the beginning of this millennium, and it is the fact that indigenous peoples and local communities have a fundamental role to